Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:19 p.m. Today we have present Representative Crox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields was here, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen, Representative Fields. Kevin Allen with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Serena Hackenmiller, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. On today's agenda, we have two bill hearings. We will start with HB 324, Insurance Data Security, from Representative Stapp, and then go to HB 55 from Representative Carrick. And let the record reflect that Representative Sadler and Representative Ruffridge joined us at 3:20 p.m. So starting with HB 324 from Representative Stapp, we heard this bill last week and received two amendments to discuss today. Three for these. We are back on the record. Representative Wright?
I move amendment ending in B.1.
That will be amendment number one.
Object.
Okay, there is objection.
Yes, I'd like to have the bill sponsor speak to the amendment.
Hello, my name's Clifton Coghill. I'm staff to Representative Stapp. And if I could actually have a lifeline behind me, speak to this amendment number one as it is.
Sure.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Would you like me to go through the amendment? Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Wright. When this bill was released with Senator Kaufman's office, the industry came back with some changes that they would like to see. We worked with them to negotiate where we thought the bill would meet in the middle. When it went over to Ledge Legal to be redrafted, there were a couple things that came back that were not correct in the CS. These two amendments are fixing those, and I can tell you what it's done by section. On page 12, going to line 18, following line 28, following information, insert an and then going over to line 13, delete and insert a period. Then we go to page 13, where we're going to delete the next paragraph, which is lines 1 through 3. What we are saying in this is that and this is going to go to judiciary for court rules, is that if you, as a consumer, were to sue the insurance company for breach of your private information, you can get the data from them, but you cannot sue the division or the director. We hold that data confidential to conduct the investigation and then come up with whatever penalty or fine may be assessed against the insurance company. So it just clarifies, you can get the information. We're not impeding your right to do that, but you can't get it from the division.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Carrick?
Thank you, through the chair, to probably Ms. Wing-Heyer. I see on page 14, we're removing reference to electronic. And just a question, why remove reference to electronic information?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, when we were talking about data breaches, and I would willingly admit that probably most information is kept electronically, but there are still some paper files within insurance companies and insurance brokerage firms. And those could contain personal information that could be breached and used against you to hit your credit report or what have you. And so it was suggested that we eliminate electronic so that all information would be subject to this bill as far as data breaches.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll remove my objection to amendment number one.
Okay, seeing no objection, amendment number one is passed. Representative Wright.
Mr. Chair, I move amendment two.
object for discussion.
Okay, there is objection. Representative Carrick, would you like to speak to your objection?
Amendment number 2, to my knowledge, and I'll gladly take clarification from the bill sponsor or the director, changes the number of employees exempted from risk assessment from 15 to, or from 10 to 15, 15 or fewer. And I am curious from either the bill sponsor's staff or the division what the rationale is behind this amendment.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, you're right. The bill exempts firms that have less than 10 employees as currently written. Representative staff ask us if we would have a concern with increasing it to 15, and we didn't. We would not object to the amendment. We think it still captures the majority of insurance agencies within the state or brokerage firms and insurance companies, which certainly have more than 15 employees.
Can I ask a question for the bill sponsor staff? Through the chair, is it would risk assessment not be a valuable, would the provisions in this bill not be a valuable tool for those agencies that have 10 to 14 employees? And I guess I appreciate the division's response, but what is sort of the intent of the amendment from the sponsor's office, or the hope?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, I really can't explain that through my boss. He would have to get back to you on that one.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Conkle, I'd sharpen that question a bit, or maybe Director Wing-Hire, what firms would be included in 15 that would not be included in a limitation 10? And given the power that computers and AI provide to individuals, even to small groups of people, again, I think it's a strange delineation. I'd just like to know what is included in 15 and not 10, a number of people.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I am sure that if we looked at all the smaller firms, the, I would say, one-man shops where you have a couple agents, you're going to find a few that are between 10 and 14, mm-hmm. if you will. But we think you're probably, in the state of Alaska, you have insurance agencies that have 5 employees because there's 1 or 2 producers, a receptionist, and a couple underwriters. And then you have the large firms. We don't think there's that many in what we could pull that are going to fall between 10 and 14.
So just to clarify, it's your opinion that it really is not particularly material because there'd be very, very few firms that it would matter.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. We discussed it with representative staff. We could not come up with a good reason to ask him not to put the amendment in. It just did not seem like it was going to hit too many agencies where consumers would not have the protections afforded in this bill.
Okay. Representative Prox, did you have?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I am guessing that, what do they call them, captive agents, that is an agent of a particular company, is generally a smaller office. And then there are independent agencies, and I'm just trying to look around Fairbanks as I'm talking. The difference would be that the captive agencies probably would have support from the mother company, if you will, but the independent agencies would have to dig into their own pocket, my guess.
Through the chair to Representative Prox, in Alaska, we have seen an incredible amount of mergers and acquisitions lately, and some of what we called the smaller agencies back when have now become the hub, is a name of an agency. They've become part of Marsh McLennan. They've become part of a bigger firm, which is going to push them into having to mandate or afford these, comply, if you will, with this bill.
Right.
And you're absolutely correct that those agencies, the captive that you were talking about for Allstate, State Farm, where agencies may have a small office, but they are captive, their firm, State Farm and Allstate, will have to be subject to this bill, making them subject to the provisions in this bill.
Mm-hmm. So, for the independent agencies, do we have any rough idea of how much this would cost them?
through the chair to Representative Prox, we do not. But I will tell you that I don't think there are very many firms that have data that are do not already have corporate governance as respects data security. And if you look, we give them, I think it's 18 months to comply with the bill so that they don't have to come up with the cost or the whatever they need to pay today. But I think it's we haven't had complaints from any. There's not a record of support, but there's not a record of opposition from the agents on this because they already have data security programs. This is just getting to when they have to tell us and how the process will go to notify consumers.
Okay. Seems reasonable. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carrick, do you maintain your objection?
I am going to maintain my objection, okay. Mr. Chair.
There is objection. Please call the roll on amendment number two.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. So by a vote of five yeas and two nays, amendment number two has passed. Do any committee members have questions for the bill sponsor or comments? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. I appreciate Mr. Coghill being here on behalf of his boss. I know people might look at this and say, where is the sponsor? I think the sponsor is on the Finance Committee. He's up addressing the operating budget, so I appreciate his interest in having his bill before us and sending his able staffer here instead, just for the record.
Thank you. Okay, seeing no other questions, Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
I do. Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move committee substitute for House Bill number 324. Version Bravo, also referred to as 33-LS1348/B, be advanced from committee as amended with individual recommendations, attach fiscal notes, and allow legislative legal to make any necessary or conforming changes.
Okay. Without objection, House Bill 324 will be reported from committee. Next on the agenda.
Got here as soon as I could.
Next on the, thank you, Representative Staff, we are done. next on the agenda is House Bill 55, a bill from Representative Carrick. We have a new version to adopt today. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
I do. Before that, I would like Representative Sadler to rescind his previous nice comments about Representative Staff. No, I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 55, version Delta, also referred to as 33-LS0360/D.
Okay, without objection, the committee substitute has been adopted as the working draft. I'd like to call Representative Carrick and her staff to approach the committee and give a brief explanation of this version of the bill.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in Fairbanks. It's Fairbanks Day around here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Stuart Relay Staff for Representative Carrick.
And I will have my staff walk through the change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The changes are pretty simple from version R, which is the Education Committee substitute, to version D, which is the new Labor and Commerce Committee substitute. They are as follows. Page 1, lines 4 through 9, delete all materials. Page 2, line 12 through page 3, line 15, delete all materials. And page 3, line 20, delete all material. And that, Mr. Chairman, brings the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute to essentially the original version of the bill, the main difference being instead of a six-year extension, there's only a two-year extension. That, Mr. Chairman, are the changes.
Okay, thank you. Do any committee members have questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor. There had been a version of the bill that we've now bypassed. It was a little more extensive revision of the program, and I guess my question would be the intent, if we're making this now a simple extension of the TVET program for 2 years, kind of short, is it your intent to come back and try again with the other provisions of the program?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Sadler. The intention of the previous committee was to make, I think, a pretty significant amount of changes to the TVET program. My main goal in bringing this legislation forward and introducing it last year was simply to ensure the reauthorization of TVEP. I do think with a tight time schedule, the intent of a lot of members, and including myself to a large extent, is just to ensure that we do reauthorize this program and we do have a chance to, with the more limited extension, put some time pressure on getting some changes and reconfigurations to TVEP considered over the course of the next intervening years before we have this legislation in front of us again.
Okay. Fair assessment. Thank you. Thanks.
Okay, we are going to open public testimony on House Bill 55 now. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 55? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Etheridge with the Alaska AFL-CIO and the Alaska Works Partnership. We appreciate the work that's been done on this bill, and I think that it's only fair to go with the extension for the 2 years and get the all the participants in the same room to talk about what changes should look like at the end, and it's a very important program to start training programs for a lot of folks, and I think it's a great idea. I appreciate your efforts in fixing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 55? Do you please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor, and I there's been an audit on this program, and it hasn't been handed out as far as I know. So I was told that I was going to be testifying at a later date. Just wanted to make sure that was still the plan. Otherwise, I can go through the audit, but it'll be have it in your packets.
We are taking public testimony at this time.
Okay. You want me to go through the audit? You might want a copy of it. You have it? Okay. All right, sweet. Okay, again, Chris Curtis, I'm your state legislative auditor. An audit was requested of this program due to concerns about the program to ensure there was objective information available to legislators prior to authorization. So I'm going to walk you through the background information starting on page 3. So this program was created in FY01, so it's been around for a long time for the purpose of adequately funding technical and vocational education and for the purpose of building capacity at the post-secondary level. The intent of the original legislation was to create a competitive grant program that was to be administered by an oversight board and to prevent a delay in awarding funds while the oversight board was preparing regulations and guidelines. That first-year funds, a provision was added to the uncodified law to award those first-year funds to three specific entities: University of Alaska, the Kotzebue Technical Center, and APTEC. So after the grant regulations were created in 2002, they were created, they were supposed to be, funds were supposed to be awarded through the competitive grant process. So the program has been, the direct award of the of training grantees has continued, though, since the program was created, first via continual provisions of uncodified law, and then in FY09, that statute that you see in HB 55 was put into statute, was codified in FY09. The number of TVET providers, though, have increased since it was originally created. First, they had those three, and then by FY22, there were 10 providers. If you look on page 4 of the audit, you'll see the 10 providers and the allocations that are in statute. You'll also see on page 5 the location of all of those training providers. TVEP is funded by diverting a percent of employee taxes from the UI fund into a subfund of the state's general fund. It was first funded by a 0.10% that was bumped up in FY09 to 0.15% and then FY15 to 0.16%. So annually, in accordance with that statute, TVEP funds are then appropriated to the 10 providers that you see on page 4. I'm now going to jump up to report conclusions, starting around page 10. So one of the objectives of the audit was just to simply report on the expenditure of the funds. $12.9 million was expended in FY22. Most of those expenditures come from the 10 training providers. But the Department of Labor and Workforce Development did incur about $400,000 of expenditures to help administer the program. While reviewing the TVEP expenditures, we did find that 7 of the 10 training providers were under awarded funds during FY22 based on calculations by the AWIB board based on preliminary estimates. Those estimates were not updated, and so collectively 7 providers were underpaid $666,000. If you look at Exhibit 3 on page 11, we identify those specific training providers that were underpaid with an asterisk next to the name. Exhibit 4 on page 12 summarizes the FY22 expenditures by category, and you'll see admin costs was 7.1% of the total. Statutes limit admin costs to no more than 5%. And what we found was that the AWIB board was not enforcing the 5% cap due to a misunderstanding that that cap was only applicable if funds were awarded via a grant process. So it's our understanding they did get guidance from Department of Law that no, that cap should be enforced, and they began to do so in FY23. Exhibit 5, page 13, reports the training expenditures by category. You'll see health is the highest category and construction is the second. Exhibit 6 summarizes the FY22 TVET participants by training category. Again, health was the largest. In total, they trained about 6,688 individuals. Exhibit 8 shows a little bit more than that because some people received more than one type of training. On page 14, we draw attention to the impact of the sweep, reverse sweep, on the TVEP subfund. TVEP subfund is subject to the Alaska constitutional requirement that the available fund balance should be transferred to the CBR at the end of the year as repayment of amounts borrowed from the CBR by the general fund. So that's called the sweep process. Historically, there was a provision in the operating budget that would restore that sweep to the subfunds that were swept, and that was called the reverse sweep. Beginning in FY22, that reverse sweep was not included in the operating budget. At the end of FY22, the TVEP subfund had a balance of $2.4 million that was swept into the CBR. Because TVEP is funded by employee taxes, that effectively resulted in the use of employee taxes to repay the CBR liability. One of the audit's objectives was to evaluate whether the program was meeting the training needs by region and by industry. And what we found is that TVEP is not operating as intended. It was intended to be a grant program administered by the state's lead employment training planning agency, which is the AWIB board. Although there is a grant process still in statute, that those grant statutes are being overridden by the other statutes that directly award training to the 10 providers. And HB 55 is reauthorizing those direct awards to the training providers. The funding process bypasses the state's lead training employment planning agency, the AWIB board. So those allocations and those payments go directly to those entities. We believe that design has limited the ability of TVEP to respond to the training needs by industry and by region. There's been no analysis as to whether the services provided by these 10 training providers are meeting the needs of the specific regions. Regional access to training, need for specific types of training, capacity for the training in the regions do not factor into the annual award process. Further, the audit concluded that this funding process does not afford all Alaska training providers an opportunity to participate in the program. Another objective of the audit was to evaluate TVEP's performance measures. We found TVEP does not have adequate performance measures. It has performance metrics in the statute, but those metrics are not evaluated against any objectives or goals. And without those benchmarking type of process, those metrics fall short of communicating the program's effectiveness. The audit also concluded that the training, these training providers, the 10, are subject to less monitoring and oversight than, say, AWIB training grantees. And that was another objective of the audit, was to evaluate the monitoring. Page 21, we discussed TVEP's impact on the balance of the UI fund and on employer UI taxes. Each year, the solvency of the UI fund is evaluated by the Department of Labor staff, and that evaluation includes calculating a reserve rate. The reserve rate is the ratio of the fund balance to the total taxable wages of Alaskan employers. If the reserve rate is less than 3%, then employers pay a fund solvency surcharge as part of their UI tax rate. If it's greater than 3.3%, then they get a credit, a solvency credit, as part of their tax rate, and their credit is, and their tax rate is lower. The period of FY01 through FY22, $204 million was diverted from the UI fund to the TVEP subfund for this program. The diversion does reduce UI fund balances. That does impact the reserve rate and could contribute to higher employer tax rates. The audit notes the STEP program, the State Training and Employment Program, is also funded by diverting a portion of employee UI tax rates. The audit has two recommendations. They begin on page 23. First, we recommend the legislature consider repealing the direct award of the 10 training providers. That would allow the TVEP funds to be paid via the statutes that have the grant process in place. Or, in other words, not authorizing the direct payments. And we also have a second recommendation to the commissioner of DLWD to work with OMB to resolve the underpayments to the 7 training providers. We do note that because the balance was swept in FY22, that correcting that on those underpayments will be more difficult. But we've directed them to work with OMB to help resolve those underpayments.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 55? And doesn't look like we have anyone online, so we will close public testimony. I'm setting an amendment deadline for Friday, April 5th at 10 a.m. on this bill. Last on today's agenda is a presentation on rail belt energy cost analysis by Paul Denholm, researcher at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Mr. Denholm, please put your name on the record and begin.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Paul Denholm. I work at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, and I'm here to talk about the potential opportunities for renewable energy to save money on the rail belts. Before I begin the presentation, I'd like to provide just a little bit of background about what the National Renewable Energy Lab is and what we do. We're part of the National Laboratory System. This is originally formed as part of the U.S. Nuclear Weapons Program, places like Los Alamos, if you saw Oppenheimer. That's how this all started. We report to the U.S. Department of Energy to do basic science, applied engineering, and research on interests associated with basic science, with a strong emphasis on energy-related issues. The National Renewable Energy Lab is an applied research lab where we focus on advancing the state of renewable energy technologies and understanding the grid implications of large-scale deployment of renewables. That's what my specialty is. I have a PhD in energy systems analysis, and I'm a principal research fellow at NREL. For about 20 years, I've been studying the U.S. power grid and the implications of adding renewable energy to the power grid, its costs, its benefits, and what it can do to provide stable, reliable, effective, and affordable energy to the nation's consumers. The origin of the study came from a request from the governor who wanted to look at an 80% RPS a number of years ago. A request came through the Department of Energy to look at the technical possibility of deploying 80% electricity on the Alaska Rail Belt, the rail belt serving about 75% of the state's electricity demand. So after a preliminary analysis of the basic feasibility of this, the wind and solar resources to provide energy in the rail belt, the question, of course, came down to, well, what would this actually cost? What might the cost benefits and opportunities be for the rail belt consumers? This is in context to the fact that in 2022, The average electricity rate for residential consumers in the U.S. was about 14 cents per kilowatt hour, while in the Rail Belt, it was 23 cents per kilowatt hour. Given the average Rail Belt annual consumption of about 7,000 kilowatt hours per year, this means that the average Rail Belt consumer spends $590 more per year for electricity than consumers in the lower 48. This is already significantly higher, but there are greater concerns about the need for importing liquefied natural gas, which provides about 60+% of the Rail Belt electricity. There are projections that with the declining natural gas supply of the Cook Inlet, there will be a need to import LNG at a considerably higher cost, north of $12 per million BTU. The implications of this alone will be an additional $75 million per year in electricity costs to Rail Belt consumers. That's on top of the already high rates that consumers in the Rail Belt are paying for electricity. So this is the real challenge that the Rail Belt faces. And so the question becomes, can renewables potentially offset some of these already high costs and potentially increasing costs? These are the
Representative Fields. I'm sorry to jump in with a question, yeah. But that was really interesting. So we pay 590 through the chair, we pay 590 per household more. I don't remember if that was household or individual. And then if you're adding 75 million per year, if you become reliant on imported LNG, do you know offhand what that translates into in a per household basis? What would it add to that 590? How much would it exacerbate that?
Just that alone would probably be about another $200 per year. So the question becomes, can renewable energy offset fuel use at the existing natural gas plants that provide the majority of the electricity in the Rail Belt? So the figure that I'm showing now is the projected cost of fuel for powering those electric generators that provide the bulk of the electricity supply along the Rail Belt. These are the what are known as combined cycle power plants, and these are the most efficient power plants in the Rail Belt fleet. And again, this provides a large fraction of the electricity. And so right now, the cost of fuel for these plants is somewhere on the order of 7 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour. The utility generally prices things in dollars per megawatt hour, so you just kind of shift the number around. But so $70 to $80 per megawatt hour corresponds to 7 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour. And so that's the cost of purchasing fuel for these plants. If the LNG problem hits, which most of the Rail Belt utilities have expressed concerns about, we're now talking potentially north of 10 cents per kilowatt hour just for buying fuel. So the question becomes, can renewable energy offset fuel, these fuel purchases, at less than the cost of purchasing natural gas? And that was really the main question here in the study, is what are the potential opportunities to reduce costs while maintaining existing levels of reliability? So one of the critical factors, of course, is discussing reliability, and that's a big focus of our work at NREL, is understanding the reliability impacts of renewables and whether or not you can maintain grid reliability with various amounts of renewables. So it's this combination of, can you reduce costs while maintaining existing level of reliability or improving levels of reliability? What we did in the study was basically ask the question, what would the difference in costs be in a transition to deploying more renewable energy? And so there's a whole host of costs that need to be considered. Basically, if you start putting more renewables in the grid, there's a series of costs associated with investing in new renewables, actually developing the wind and solar technologies, but also all of the costs associated with integrating those resources onto the power grid. Because as we know, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And so there's a bunch of things that have to be done to make sure that you maintain that level of reliability. And that's a big part of what we focus on at NREL, is understanding what historically have been known as integration costs. These are both the physical costs of interconnecting wind and solar to the grid, but also the costs associated with how you change the operation of the power system. You're going to have to change how you operate your combined cycle, your natural gas plants. Instead of operating them what we call in baseload mode, where they're kind of outputting constant amounts of electricity, you're actually changing, you're varying the output of the power plants. And this can change the costs of maintaining those power plants, the costs of starting and stopping them, and the costs physically just changing their output. All of these things need to be considered when you're adding renewable energy to the power grid. What we did is we followed what's called the standard integrated resource planning process, where you basically decide what is the right or quote, optimum mix of resources, the least cost mix of resources. And then you do a bunch of simulations where you actually simulate the hour-to-hour operation of power plants. You kind of have pretend failures, and you do all those kinds of things to kind of break the grid to make sure that you can maintain reliable service. So that process is what we followed here. This is kind of standard stuff. This has been done for many decades in kind of the utility industry. We modeled the entire rail belt. This includes the four main utilities, Golden Valley, MEA, Chugach, and Homer on the Kenai the Kenai Peninsula. We did assume that there's a transition to greater coordination across the rail belt. That's a big assumption because we found in other regions around the U.S., as you have more coordination among utilities, you have more kind of buying and selling of energy, you can do things more efficiently. But we do not assume consolidated utilities. We're not assuming that the local utilities lose control over things like setting rates and establishing what they build. We're just saying that there needs to be more coordination of both how the system is planned as how the system is operated. We ran a set of scenarios to understand what would the costs of basically doing nothing would be. So a no new renewable scenario where we just took the existing fleet and we continue to do kind of business as usual, continue to primarily rely on natural gas. And then we compared that to what we're calling the reference scenario, where all new generation resources are allowed. This includes both fossil and renewable energy. Whatever the simulation shows is the least cost mix, that's what we let it do, and then figured out what the cost differences would be associated with doing, again, the optimum solution. We also did an RPS case where we enforced the 80% by 2040 renewables portfolio standard, and then some cases where we looked at higher and lower renewable energy costs. I won't go through kind of in detail all the different technologies we considered, but again, we kind of the standard suite of fossil and renewable technologies. I highlighted perhaps one of the more important ones that we did not do was consider new large hydropower. This includes the Dixon diversion at Bradley Lake, which has the potential to increase output at that plant. There's a number of other large proposed hydro plants. I think a comprehensive study does need to incorporate those possible generation facilities as well, but we didn't have the data available to evaluate those. So in that sense, we kind of restricted making this more of a worst-case scenario where we limited the availability of new hydro and focused primarily on new wind and solar. There's a number of other renewable energy technologies considered as well, such as geothermal, but primarily wind and solar were the primary resources evaluated. We evaluated the system out to 2040 with some load growth based on population, as well as adoption of electric vehicles using the most conservative kind of vehicle adoption possible. So this overall added about 20% of demand to the electric system. A big part of the study, of course, is understanding the potential opportunity and need for new transmission. We analyzed the existing main two transmission interconnections, the main, the Alaska intertie, running from Fairbanks down to the kind of Anchorage area. That's about 80 megawatts of transfer capacity. We did not include any upgrades there. There's a lot of proposed upgrades, but again, we wanted to kind of have a more conservative approach, assuming no upgrades. We did, however, upgrade the flows on the Kenai intertie, running again from the Kenai up into Anchorage. We assume that this is upgraded to 185 megawatts in 2033 as part of the Rail Belt Innovative Resiliency Project. So this is federal dollars coming here. There need to be some matching funds to build this up, but it's free money that I think would be potentially very beneficial to the grid, actually regardless of whether or not new renewables are added. It can just do a lot more to enhance the reliability and resiliency of the system. Okay, so the big then question is, what does it cost to acquire new renewable energy? And how might that compare to the cost of continuing to use primarily rely on natural gas? One of the great things about working at NREL is I've been able to see the tremendous decrease in wind and solar cost, as well as increase in performance over the past two decades. We've seen wind and solar go from, quite frankly, experimental technologies that were, you know, kind of hippie-ish things deployed in California to mainstream technologies that are being deployed throughout the U.S. By most utilities in the U.S. as measures to reduce the cost of operating their grid. Renewables are generally cheaper than deploying new fossil fuel resources in pretty much all of the U.S. The U.S. happens, at least in the lower 48, happens to have some of the best wind and solar resources on the planet. Alaska, while not as great for solar resources, does have tremendous wind resources, And their solar resources are surprisingly good. I always have to remind myself how much the sun shines here at night, during the summer. So we actually find cost-competitive solar as well as significant wind resources here in Alaska. The costs of acquiring these new renewables, of course, include the cost of actually building the wind and solar and interconnecting the grid. The capital and fixed O&M costs can be captured via a power purchase agreement. This is actually really important because one of the big concerns about any utility, especially municipally and cooperatively owned utilities, is the cost of raising new debt, the cost of financing new projects. We are neutral as to whether or not utilities acquire new renewables either through kind of the we will build it, we will take out a municipal bond and build it ourselves, or acquire through a power purchase agreement. The nice thing about a power purchase agreement is all of the capital requirements are transferred onto a private developer. What a power purchase agreement says that I will purchase renewable energy for a fixed price over a long-term contract, typically 20, 25 years. Every kilowatt hour of energy generated by the wind and solar, I will pay a certain amount for, 6, 7, 8 cents per kilowatt hour. If it doesn't generate, I don't pay a dime. I only pay for the energy actually produced by the generation facility. So in terms of risk of, gosh, maybe this year or this day might not be particularly windy, that's the developer's problem, not mine. I only take the energy that's actually produced, and I can use that energy to offset those natural gas purchases. So again, that's a potentially great way of avoiding the need to raise new debt. On top of that, of course, there are some investments that need to be made. Some of these can be made as part of the power purchase agreement, so interconnection costs can sometimes be done that way. But there are some capital investments that will probably need to be made by the local utility. A big part of the issue around integrating renewables is this concept of integration costs. This is the cost of dealing with the variability and uncertainty of these resources. The fact that you can't always predict when the wind is going to blow and when the sun is going to shine, or at least when the clouds are going to pass over the sun. So integration costs are always a big part of doing these types of studies. And NREL has been doing these types of things for 20 years, understanding what it takes to actually integrate large amounts of renewables onto the grid. So I'll briefly touch on those just a bit later. I just wanted to highlight a couple of other things. A big part of the benefits of renewables, of course, are associated with the investment tax credit that's available through the Inflation Reduction Act. We assume a 40% ITC, and that's based on how the Rail Belt qualifies as an energy community. I'm happy to answer questions about that. There's another element, of course, is the fact that renewables are more expensive in Alaska, given the fact that just about everything is more expensive in Alaska. So we use some baseline assumptions on how much more it costs to develop new renewable energy projects in Alaska. These range from a minimum right now of about 50% to maybe as high as 85% higher in the state of Alaska compared to the lower 48. We assume that these do go down over time to converge on kind of just the standard fact that things like housing and road construction is more expensive in the state of Alaska based on a maturing marketplace. But again, an important part of this is recognizing the fact that renewables are more expensive in Alaska. And that's reflected just as here as an example, where I'm showing the cost curves. I'm showing the declining cost over time for wind and solar in Alaska. Those are the solid lines at the top compared to our best estimates for the costs of wind and solar in the lower 48. So you can see that significantly higher price in the state of Alaska. I'm going to skip over the details of this. I'm happy to talk about the assumed costs of wind and solar if you'd like. But again, the big thing is we have the combination of they're significantly higher in Alaska, but there is the potential for declining costs both due to technology improvements as well as a larger potential market in Alaska. Yes,
Representative Prox.
I hate to take too much time, but the assumption that the cost of renewables will continue to decline. Some argue that as we expand the demand on the minerals needed to produce the windmills or the solar panels, that we're going to reach supply, current mm-hmm. supply, and the price of those is going to have to go up. Have you thought about that, and is there measurement of that risk?
Yes, there's excellent data available on the price trends. Over the past 20 years, we've seen continual decline in the cost of wind and solar with two notable blips that have occurred. One happened about 12 years ago where we did have some supply chain disruption around wind turbines. And we saw a blip, more than a blip. It actually kind of took a couple of years for it to kind of continue down on that path. And the second thing happened, of course, after COVID, when everything went crazy. However, the good news is we've seen we're back on track with declining. So the most recent quarterly reports we've seen, particularly for solar, show that we're back on track to declining costs. One of the nice things about wind and solar in particular is, for the most part, they don't have a huge dependence on things like rare earths. There's a little bit in wind turbines, but wind is basically concrete and steel and fiberglass, whereas solar is primarily sand and a few other metals. And again, you've got the foundation materials like concrete and steel. So we don't see the same types of potential supply chain disruptions that we do for things like lithium-ion batteries. So we do see continued cost reductions. Again, geopolitical instabilities aside, there should be continued declining costs for these technologies.
Representative Prox.
And thank you, through the chair, just to press that a little more. I'm guessing that more lithium batteries are going to be needed, and that's where the potential cost, extra increase in cost. We're running out of the lithium in the ground, and you have to discover and develop more lithium and copper and a few other things. And has that been estimated?
Yes. So the availability of lithium and other materials for batteries is of significant concern to the U.S. Department of Energy for a variety of national security-related issues, as well as just the general well-being of the U.S. economy. The issue is not necessarily around lithium supply. There's plenty of lithium. Lithium is actually quite abundant. It goes to the fairly limited number of locations where it is mined. Unfortunately, some of those are in places that are, you know, friendly to the U.S. A lot of it is in Chile, and we do have quite a bit available in the U.S. I think the issue really is around the classic issues: can you gain access to those lithium resources? And there's a number of metals, such as cobalt, that those are particularly in very sensitive places around the world. So there's been a trend towards non-cobalt based lithium batteries. So yes, there is a great amount of concern about the supply of these resources, again, more around the geopolitical aspects of it rather than raw material availability.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, which is how we communicate here in the committee. Through the chair, Mr. Chair. I know that the federal tax credits, I think the 44Q, 46Q, puts a big thumb on the scale on the affordability of renewable energy. What is there baked in anywhere in your assumptions that these tax credits will continue ad infinitum, or is there a risk that's calculated of them going away and thus changing, setting a lot of the financial assumptions cattywampus?
Yes. Sorry, I don't know the protocol here. So, the assumption is that they go forward per the existing provisions as written in law, and so they do expire eventually. But as long as you start the projects within a certain amount of time, which is basically kind of in time to get them done by the 2040 type timeframe, they'll remain available. So we don't consider kind of the larger political question of what happens if the law is fundamentally changed.
We do have a provision in Alaska where certain programs are subject to appropriation. We pass a law that says we're going to do this if we have the money. I don't know if the similar restrictions or conditions apply in federal systems, or if there's an ironclad argument that if you begin your project, you will get the tax credits, or if those are subject to appropriation. In your position as a national laboratory in renewables, you might be more informed about that than any of us here. Is that going to happen? Could that happen, rather?
How do I respond?
Through the chair.
So, as I understand the way that the Inflation Reduction Act is written, we do not think that there's any issues with that particular aspect of the law as it applies to the Alaska system. I'm relying on kind of other tax experts and who've looked at what the IRS has said in terms of eligibility to as the basis of this analysis. So that's a lot of words for saying we assume full eligibility for the entire kind of tranche of renewables that are constructed for this project.
Thank you.
Thank you. The analysis of renewables in Alaska looked at the wind and solar resource available through the entire Rail Belt region. One of the things that we particularly highlighted was, and would note, is the highest quality wind resources along the Rail Belt are not near the largest population centers. This is quite frankly similar to what we find in the lower 48, where it's windy oftentimes where people don't live. And so you do need a fair amount of transmission capacity. Again, fortunately, we are able to take advantage of the existing Alaska intertie for some of that. So we're supplying the load in Fairbanks directly, as well as using the Alaska intertie, and then developing new renewable resources on the Kenai intertie and taking advantage of that new transmission capacity that we assume available in 2033. And so the bottom line is that we think that both wind and PV can be developed below the avoided cost of natural gas. And this is really important to emphasize. Again, going back to the fact that if the price of just purchasing natural gas is somewhere in the order of 10 cents per kilowatt hour, if you can build new solar or new wind for less than that, you will save money. I really think it's that simple. Obviously, there's a lot of other factors involved that I'll get into in terms of integration. But again, this provides the opportunity to avoid the cost of natural gas and those costs associated with natural gas, and do a couple of other things like provide bill stability. So one of the things that we often talk about when we're talking about natural gas infrastructure, of course, is the volatility of the natural gas prices. After the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we saw natural gas global market prices for LNG spike up to somewhere around $20 per million BTU, significantly higher than the $12 per million BTU we assumed here. Now, again, those costs have come back down. So we have not seen sustained prices of $20 per million BTU, but there's just an exposure to that volatility. When you lock in prices for power purchase agreements, that's a guarantee. For the portion of the load served by renewables, you know 20 years out what the cost of that amount of electricity will be, what fraction of that bill will be. So that makes, particularly for your large industrial commercial consumers, that means that they can have a better idea of what to charge for their products and services because they know how much they're going to be paying for electricity. We considered a large number of integration costs associated with this. And this is really important to emphasize the fact that there, again, these are a critical role of any type of analysis is understanding how much does it cost to actually provide things like operating reserves and other services needed to successfully integrate wind and solar onto the power grid. There are a lot of uncertainties around these. A number of them include things like natural gas fuel storage requirements. But again, we did our best estimate of these costs based largely on input from the utilities themselves. So for instance, the cost of natural gas, we used estimates from the utilities to try and, again, do our best estimates of what the full cost of integration might be. So we have to talk about what the potential reliability benefits are of renewables and how we consider the impact of renewables on reliability. And so the bottom line is when we talk about what we assume what wind and solar can provide in terms of reliability benefits, we assume that there aren't any. We're not actually relying on the wind to blow or the sun to shine. We're maintaining the existing fossil fuel fleet. That's the power plants that are there to provide the capacity needed on those cold winter nights. The only thing that renewables are doing is reducing the amount of natural gas burned at these plants and offsetting the cost of purchasing this fuel. So that's the only thing we're accounting for. And again, we're accounting for those benefits after taking into account the costs of integrating them onto the rail belt grid. So in terms of what we find was that the lower cost of renewable energy, the lower cost of wind and solar, results in large deployments of wind and solar in the least cost scenario. We build up to getting about 76% of the rail belt electricity from renewables in 2040 due to their lower costs, due to their ability to offset natural gas. This results in net savings that reach about $100 million per year in the 2030s. So this is constant 2023 dollars, about $100 million per year. What you see on the far right-hand graph is the comparison of the investments in kind of the lower bars to the costs in the upper bars. So we're spending money on renewables and we're reducing the amount of natural gas, and that's what's resulting in that $100 million per year savings. Cumulatively, this is over $1 billion in savings. So this isn't, you know, again, we're considering both the costs and the benefits. We are spending $2.9 billion in renewables and other integration-related costs, and we're avoiding about $4.2 billion in fuel and other fossil-related costs. That's where this net of $1.3 billion comes from. Again, it's the comparison of the cost that you're spending to the benefits that you're getting.
Chair Sumner?
Representative Brox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I forget the number already, but we're spending money. Somebody is spending money.
Yes.
But from the perspective of the legislature, somebody else is spending money under this plan. The independent power producers are spending the money, not the legislature, except for the shared capital of the intertie.
Through the chair, yes. So again, these costs and benefits are all going through, you know, somebody has to spend that $4.2 billion in fuel, and that's coming out of the pockets of the consumers. That's money that's coming out of, you know, from the consumers to the electric company and from the electric company to the natural gas suppliers. So that's that throughput. The $2.9 billion is kind of the same thing. It's the consumers who are using electricity spending that money to the electric utilities, and then that money is going from the electric utilities largely to the independent power producers. So this does not require any kind of direct state dollar spent. In terms of the actual source of the electricity, this is about coming about 50% from wind, and the remaining coming from a mix of solar and existing hydro, and of course, you know, roughly 25% coming from the existing fossil resources. And again, it's important to emphasize that the existing fossil resources are maintained for reliability purposes. Again, we're not depending on the wind to blow. We're using the existing natural gas plants. We're just using them less. We're displacing the energy that would have been produced by these fossil plants otherwise if we did not invest in these renewable resources. In terms of where we're actually building this and how much, we're building it throughout the rail belt. But again, we're deploying a lot in the highest quality wind resource locations up near Fairbanks and down on the Kenai, again, taking advantage of that new transmission capacity. That is an important finding of the study, is really being able to take advantage of that new transmission capacity in the Kenai and taking advantage of those good wind resources down there. So that's an important component of this. It'd be great if there are, you know, more good wind resources in the central region, but you got to go with what you got. And there are some good wind resources in the central region. So there's a number of locations that are under consideration for development there, but there are also some really good wind resources up north and down south. So everything I've talked about so far has been the kind of this reference case, which is what is the least cost, the optimum solution. So then the question is, well, what about the 80% RPS? You know, what would that do in terms of costs? And what we do find is that an 80% reduction, 80% RPS does reduce somewhat the overall benefit. However, when you actually look at the size of that reduction, it's really quite small and quite frankly in the noise practically compared to other impacts. So the best way that I can express this is, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around things like natural gas costs and cost of renewables. If the cost of renewables were, say, 10% more expensive or 20% more expensive or 10% less expensive, those differences would greatly overwhelm the reduction in benefits associated with an 80% RPS. So kind of the uncertainty in the benefits is much greater than the impact of the RPS. So that's why we kind of say that one of the findings is that this results in the 80% RPS results in roughly a 2% change in the cumulative savings. And again, that would be overwhelmed by the actual savings differences that would result from uncertainty in these costs. So we don't really see a real impact of an 80% RPS compared to what we think the ideal solution would be.
Representative Fields? Did
you have a question? Thanks to the chair, Mr. Denholm. I was just going to say this committee has not received a presentation from anyone on NREL's study, finding that I think a 75-76% portfolio is the cheapest. So I was just going to say, don't assume that we know about that. So as you're presenting 80%, it is marginally different from the 76% least cost scenario. And maybe just contextualize that since we haven't heard that presentation. Thank you.
The chair, thank you. Yes, I should have kind of clarified that. One of the challenges, of course, is that we are talking about the difference between what the optimum solution would be as compared to the 80% RPS. And yes, so this is the reference case does represent kind of that what we think would the absolute least cost solution would be. It would be that 75, 76% number. Thank you. So a number of these findings are focused primarily on the reliability aspects of this, which I think is probably perhaps less important in this particular context. But we do often emphasize these, particularly when we're talking to utilities, because we do need to emphasize the amount of work. Quite frankly, more work goes into studying the reliability aspects of the grid than the cost savings. We spend a lot of time on both, but I'm a reliability engineer primarily. So my primary job when I think about what I do for day-to-day living is keeping the lights on. And so we emphasize the role of the existing fossil plants to maintain reliability. And then this is the graph that I often show to utilities. This is what I call kind of the scary graph, because this this represents this the volatility of the renewable resources in terms of, you know, every day you're kind of kept on your toes. And this does require a change in how the system is operated. This will require software upgrades, some of which we do actually do account for. We account for $1.5 million a year in software updates and software upgrades. That's probably not all you need to do. There's additional software upgrades that you need to account for the fact that you need to be able to forecast, do a better job of forecasting the wind and solar, changing operational practices, training staff. There's a lot of things that need to be done. It's not as simple as just putting a bunch of wind and solar on the grid and crossing your fingers and hope it works. We've got, again, 2 decades of experience in the utility industry and the lower 48 with this. We know that this takes work to do it. Again, you're going to save money, but it does take work to save all this money. I'll skip over one more of these items, but just kind of conclude on this one, which is, again, to emphasize the fact that the integration costs are an important part of the study. So, for instance, we are looking at tens of millions of dollars of costs associated with integrating these, but that is included in the net savings. So, again, that $100 million per year plus of savings is accounted for. It does account for these integration costs. It's important to emphasize the role of integration costs and the need to evaluate these kinds of cost savings. So that's it in a nutshell. Again, I think the most important thing here is we find that new renewable resources do have the opportunity to displace existing natural gas in these plants. There are a large number of caveats that need to be studied. We do need to look at the potential for even further cost reductions associated with deploying new hydropower options, as well as kind of ancillary benefits of the potential reduction in natural gas consumption and cost impacts for heating, which were beyond the scope of this study. But they're happy to take any questions about this at this time.
Representative Fields.
Thanks for the chair. Following up on Representative Sadler's question, my recollection is the NREL study finding that 76% is the least cost solution for the rail belt really didn't rely on the 45Q tax credit for carbon storage. It just assumed that the ITC and PTC are there today, which they are in law. Is my recollection correct?
The chair, that is correct. We did not actually consider new carbon capture and sequestration options. So that would be another option. We also did not consider new things like small modular reactors, so that would be another thing to look at. We did consider new coal plants without carbon capture and sequestration. Those were found to be kind of uneconomic compared to new renewables. But yes, if you're looking at something like a clean energy standard that considers something like CCUS, that would be another thing to consider.
All right. Anybody else? No? Oh, Representative Fields.
I'll get the line behind.
Oh, Representative Rufford, you didn't see your hand.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. So in the case of the variability and the cost estimates, who bears the cost for the number of essentially battery systems that would be necessary to offset the variability of wind and solar? Would that fall to the utility, or would that fall to the utility and an independent power producer in these scenarios, as I would assume we would need quite a bit more extensive battery storage along the grid?
Through the chair. Yes, those costs could be through either a power purchase agreement or through utility direct investment. So again, we're neutral as to which party under kind of incurs those costs. Ultimately, it's really just up to the utility to decide what the best business model would be for them, whether or not they want to incur the capital, take on the capital themselves and do it. Sometimes municipal utilities and cooperative utilities can get lower costs of money. So again, being not for profit entities, it can sometimes be better for them to do things like take municipal bonds and pay for them directly and develop the projects themselves. I mean, it depends on their comfort taking on that debt, as well as their comfort with developing the technologies themselves. Again, the alternative is to just do a power purchase agreement where they pay a developer who may have more expertise in developing these technologies for some kind of long-term fixed price contract. Again, the beauty of that is it reflects more the variable. It's more of a variable cost, whereas it's just a monthly payment that kind of is a pass through that ultimately the ratepayers pay. So again, we're neutral as to which business model works best for the utilities at hand.
Just to follow up that, so were those costs for essentially additional BESS systems included in?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you know what percentage of the photovoltaic manufacturing occurs in China?
So a large fraction of panels are still made in China. When we look at the total cost of installing a PV system, we tend to look at kind of the total domestic content percentage. Because one of the nice things is that the cost of the panels themselves is now well under 50% of the total cost of the entire project. So we know that roughly 50% is going to be the on-site development. So the local putting in the foundations, all the installation, all the racking, the mounting, all that's going to be done with local labor. So at least 50% of the costs are going to be occur here in the state. The other 50%, a lot of that is going to be, some of it's going to be domestic content. I mean, there are a number of PV manufacturers in the U.S. The inverters are largely overseas in Asia, so it's a real mix. But I can get you much more detailed numbers on domestic content for historical installations of both PV and wind. At NREL, as well as our sister lab, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, we do detailed tracking of domestic content and the origins of the various suppliers for both wind and solar in the U.S.
Yeah, that'd be great. Actually, I was just wondering what the impact of, say, 60% tariffs on China would be. I assume there would ultimately be manufacturing switching back to the United States, but the Chinese may be subsidizing the energy costs of the manufacturing of the photovoltaics.
We've seen significant growth in domestic manufacturing, as well as, quite frankly, manufacturing other parts. A lot of it is occurring in other parts of Asia as well, which aren't subject to the tariffs. I mean, it's a global commodity market, kind of like everything else, clothes and everything else. We're facing some of those pressures, but we've certainly have seen increased domestic manufacturing. Wind has been a real success story. I mean, given the higher cost of shipping wind components, we see much greater fraction. You can buy basically 100% made in America wind turbines. Okay.
Representative Prox.
I understand through the chair. I understand that you're assuming the existing natural gas-fired and coal-fired plants will continue to operate.
Yes.
And some of those, in particular, in Gold Valley system, are reaching the end of their useful life.
The Golden Valley BESS system is going to be retired soon, right. That's my understanding. But the thermal plants, I mean, you can run a gas plant for many decades. So we originally proposed to retire some of the gas plants to the utilities and said, no, we've got plans to keeping these online until the late 2030s at least. So we didn't retire anything other than the Healy Unit 2 coal plant based on recommendations from GVA. I think there may be some uncertainty around that, but all the gas plants, we're keeping them running.
Okay. Well, the point is you talked to GVEA. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we talked to every single utility multiple times throughout the study. It was great. Sorry, it was great working with the local utilities. I'm an engineer. I like talking shops. So.
Okay. Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. I have more of a forward-looking question. There's a lot of
technological advancement in terms of storage, large-scale storage, smaller-scale storage. I know Chugach is exploring that with some of its larger customers in Anchorage. Could you talk about what changes that could portend in terms of electricity to heating opportunities? How will that affect the potential for renewable deployment and managing variable electric inputs? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, we make fairly conservative assumptions about the evolution of energy storage technologies. We have what's called, NREL publishes every year something called the annual technology baseline, where we do our forecasts of the cost and performance of various renewable and storage technologies in the coming decades. For storage, we actually assume no new breakthroughs or no new technologies are available between now and 2040. We just assume that current lithium-ion battery technologies will kind of continue on their current trajectories. We hope that's not true, but we tend to use fairly conservative assumptions about the evolution of technologies, rather be wrong on the conservative side than the other way around. So there are a number of technologies that are under development in early deployment stages, long duration batteries, alternative chemistries, a lot of chemistries using materials that are very easily domestically sourced, and the lingo is earth abundant materials that can be manufactured at low cost, and a lot of them have a lot of promise. So this would make renewable integration of renewables less costly, more cost effective in general. But again, what we wanted to do here is just to assume things don't get dramatically better. We just have continued incremental improvements to the technology. As far as heating applications, that's another thing that we didn't look at in a whole lot of detail in this study, but I think worthy of looking at, whether it's things like ground source or geothermal heat pumps, or maybe something more exotic like power to hydrogen. You know, hydrogen is kind of the big thing that people are talking about. We didn't do any assumptions around hydrogen in this study, again, to be conservative, but that's another set of technologies that hold a lot of promise for application beyond heating and transport fuels and all kinds of stuff like that.
Pesca follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. I'm aware that your assumptions didn't include any of that, but I guess what I was asking is, what are you seeing being deployed in more advanced grids in lower 48 in terms of innovative storage? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, through the chair. So basically, we're seeing early demonstration phase technology deployments. So these are not generally cost effective yet. They're being deployed through a combination of state subsidies, federal subsidies, early stage R&D projects to get these things onto the grid. But there's a number of battery types that use a number of. One of them is called a flow battery. They use liquid electrolytes. You put them in tanks, kind of like the big oil storage tanks. They're just a lot smaller than that. Those use materials, again, that are much lower cost. There's technologies that use iron as the kind of the storage medium. That's really cheap stuff. So there's a number of technologies that we're seeing deployed. Again, they're not being deployed because they are the most cost-effective option. We're deploying tons and tons of batteries in the grid right now because they actually totally make sense on a dollar basis. But we are seeing some of these alternative technologies being deployed in kind of early demonstration phases. There's a lot of stuff going on in the hydrogen space as well that is fairly early stage. It's not quite cost effective. Again, we hope that these technologies will be cost effective in the coming years and decades. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. How much of the assumed demand is due to growth other than residential growth?
Through the chair, in this,
I think you made that distinction. Some was residential, some was growth in electric vehicles.
Yes. We only assumed growth in electric demand based on population growth and electric vehicles. So we assumed a 20% total growth in electric demand between now and 2040, the majority of that being electric vehicles. That's the only change we made.
And 2030, did you say?
2040.
Okay. So that's a long ways out.
Yes.
The reason I bring it up through the chair is that we were talking to auto dealers last week, Interior in particular, and they're saying that there's starting to be some resistance that they can't get rid of used electric vehicles. People get the
tax credit from a new one, but when it comes time to buy, to trade that in or something, the used electric vehicle isn't marketable, more or less, or at a substantially reduced price. So that casts some doubt on the viability of electric vehicles in Alaska. Is that worth considering? Let's, for the worst case scenario, it falls on its head and there is no increase from electric vehicles. Does that really change the result comparing something or other to your model?
I think it would make a small difference. I don't think it would really fundamentally change the overall result. We might see a 5% difference in the result one way or the other, but I don't think it'd be large enough to really change the result overall.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Anybody else? Oh, Representative Carey.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm wondering, and this may not be the right person to ask, but how essential is the stability of the grid and the GRIP funding that's currently a proposal before the legislature? I mean, how essential is that component to actually seeing some of these projects move forward and achieve the reliability that I think we hope for?
Through the chair, so really interesting question. I can answer that in a couple different ways, one of which is the deployment of new wind and solar in kind of the from Anchorage north is not dependent on that funding, right? That new infrastructure basically provides benefits to the Kenai, you know, between the Kenai and Anchorage. So a lot of that does accrue to Anchorage, but overall, you if that went away, and I think it's a cool project, so I'd like to see it happen. But if that didn't happen, you could still deploy a significant amount of wind in the Kenai, take advantage of the existing Kenai intertie. You could still deploy wind up near Fairbanks, take advantage of the Alaska intertie. You just wouldn't see the kind of benefits you'd see otherwise. And one of the things I think is interesting that I think is notable is just in some of the preliminary analysis that we did. We saw benefits of deploying that system regardless of renewables. We saw reliability benefits. We saw economic savings even without consideration of renewables. We didn't try and isolate that, but we would note that project, independent of renewables, does provide significant benefits to the Red Belt Grid.
I've just followed through the chair. And those economic benefits, do they apply more grid-wide, so including north of Anchorage? Taking out the renewables piece.
Through the chair. So there's kind of two parts to that question. One is kind of the easier technical part, and one is the kind of more deeper philosophical question. The easier part is most of the benefits would occur kind of on the south side. However, we actually do see benefits continuing to flow up into the Fairbanks region. They're not huge, but they're not zero. I think one of the bigger, though, issues is one of the real challenges of any of these types of policies is the fact that there are, you know, different levels of benefits occurring to different parts of the rail belt. So, you know, the overall benefits, you know, this $100 million per year aren't going to be exactly equal to each region on any kind of like a populated weighted basis. So everybody is going to be a winner, but some people are going to be winners more than others. And that is one of the reasons why it can be challenging to do these kind of large regional projects, is because you do need to allocate that you know, who's winning more than other people. Again, I would not say that there's winners and losers here. There's just bigger winners than others. And how you allocate those wins to the various stakeholders is a really important question.
Oh, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, did I understand correctly that the upgrade of the transmission system north of Anchorage isn't essential to making this work?
Through the chair, I would love to see the Alaska intertie upgraded. Mm-hmm. I think that it would also provide significant benefits to the rail belt, regardless of renewable deployment.
However, given the uncertainty, the challenges of associating, challenges of doing transmission upgrades, we decided not to do it. We said, you know, we just don't know if that can occur, how long it would take. So let's make the conservative assumption that we're not going to touch the Alaska intertie. We're going to run it different. We're going to use it a lot more, but we're not going to upgrade it. So all of the benefits here are associated with no changes to the Alaska intertie.
A follow-up.
Go ahead.
That surprises me. And it would seem to me that the area that I'm concerned about, the interior Golden Valleys, they would be much more limited in the capacity of renewables that you could put on because of the instability.
Through the chair. Okay, so there's multiple parts to that question. We are building huge amounts of renewables up around Fairbanks, and so we are flooding the Fairbanks region with renewables. And then what's left over with that Fairbanks can't use, that's all getting shipped down on the Alaska intertie. So we are completely loading up that Alaska intertie thousands of hours of the year to get that lower cost wind energy from the Fairbanks area down into the central region. So in terms of the stability issues, that's a separate technical issue, and that would require the use of some power electronics-based technologies that are pretty well understood to address the stability problems. Because, yeah, if you did it right now with current inverter technology, yeah, you destabilize the northern part of that grid. So you do need to deploy what are called grid-forming inverters. And actually, we do pay for those. We have a little blip in the cost of deploying renewables that occurs in the late 2020s because we're adding these extra power electronic-based components to stabilize the northern grid, because you can't do it without adding stability. Measures.
And through the chair, that is figured into your calculations, your model.
Through the chair, yes. We have good confidence that the use of grid-forming inverters could solve the stability problems. We have experience doing that. The best example of that is the Kauai Electric utility in Kauai, Hawaii. They're hitting 90% instantaneous contribution of what are called inverter-based resources. That's the thing. That's the buzzword. It's not just about renewables, because it's not hydro, that's easy. It's about wind and solar that use power electronics. When you get to really high contributions of these inverter-based resources, you have to do something differently. Because if you don't, you're going to have frequency problems, this inertia problem that people talk about. You can't keep doing things like you are now. And so places like Kauai, places in Australia, have pioneered the use of these grid-forming inverters. Kauai's been doing it for 5 years now. So we have multiple years of experience in small grids in the U.S. There are a bunch of larger grids. Ireland's been doing this for a long time. So we've got a lot of experience doing it. But it does take, again, it takes work, new software, new training. A lot of work needs to be done to get a stable grid with large amounts of inverter-based resources.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Fields.
Well, I was just going to say through the chair, following up on Representative Prox's remark, maybe we should hear from some of the utilities. What I recollect from John Burns with GVA is that we actually have to fund this phase of GRIP because the utilities are applying for the next phase of GRIP, which does go up to Healy. Mm-hmm. I think they're putting in that application on April 17th. If we don't match this phase, they certainly won't get the next phase. And what GVA and Kinross have said is that to deploy the cheaper resources up in Fairbanks, they do have to be able to dispatch that energy down to South Central. So the lack of that capacity means they can't deploy the cheaper energy that's necessary to keep Kinross online and drive down costs for Fairbanks customers. But that's obviously different than this testifier's role. So maybe we should hear from him because it is a compelling case. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't want to hog him, but I do have
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Independent power producers. Through the chair. Independent power producers. It looks like it's relatively small and relatively new companies that are proposing these projects, which, not to criticize them, but the fact is there's more risk of them making some sort of mistake and they can't deliver. Is that a significant consideration?
Through the chair, I absolutely cannot comment on any of those types of issues. I don't know the players on the ground. I know the players on the ground in the lower 48. I mean, these are big companies that you know, kind of have decades of experience, and we're seeing very large deployments. I mean, one of the things I didn't highlight is just when you look at the total, for instance, the total amount of wind deployed over the kind of 15-year period of the study, that's the amount of wind that the state of Iowa deployed in 1 year. So in 2020, Iowa, the single state of Iowa, deployed all the wind that would be required in the study over the 15-year period. And most of that was developed by these independent power producers. But again, I don't know the players in Alaska.
Okay. Just to follow up, you would reduce that risk by having more people in the market. Have you looked at, are there enough independent power producers thinking about operating in Alaska that the risk of any one of them falling on their face is fairly low?
So through the chair, so I love that question, because one of the motivations, I think, for RPSs, and one of the things we've seen in the lower 48 in terms of, you know, why would you do an RPS if these things are cost effective anyway? And it is to spur that marketplace. It is to kind of unleash the free market and create multiple people kind of duking it out for that. So we've seen incredibly aggressive pricing in the lower 48 when you've got multiple vendors. And so I think the idea, at least in theory, of something like an RPS is you do create that opportunity where you do have more than just a handful of people kind of duking out and proposing aggressive pricing.
Thank you.
Anyone else? No? Okay. Thank you. That concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:46 p.m.